tonight's episode, Triangle of Terror.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of Every Second Matters. So Every Second Matters is an awareness campaign. It's been going on since 2013. In fact, we got Luke in here who was actually hosting the first rooms back in November of 2013 or something like that, when we started to see the consequences of the reaction to Obama's executive actions, his 23 executive actions at the beginning of 2013 as a reaction to the atrocity in Connecticut. So somebody's got a hot mic or something, a Revenol on a mic. And then I can't tell who it is. Rob, maybe?
What?
So we got a bunch of people get together back in the day that were hanging out in these live chats, and we knew that the grassroots sort of resistance or the grassroots results weren't going to just happen or should be focused on. So as an attempt to do something to keep that alive, or to keep that, remember that stuff, we started doing some conversations to come up with something, and then we came up eventually with the idea to do something as far as awareness of the Second Amendment and what it protects on the second day of each month. And now it is a long time later, and people do different things on the second day of the month. What I do is host a conversation, and I invite a bunch of people into it. We have a channel over here on YouTube where we put these things. So thanks, everybody, for showing up. We'll have people that watch us live, and we'll have comments up on the screen. Like DJ was out there earlier, and Echo was out there and in here, and Makojo's out there. And then a bunch of people joined us live. So I want to thank everybody. I'll introduce everyone, and then I'll shut up, and we'll just talk about Second Amendment and what it protects. So in no particular order, we'll just go in the order that's on the screen right now. At the top left, we got Rob, co-founder of Tusk, the universal settlement coin. It's a cyber coin focused on Second Amendment. I'm just going to introduce everybody, and then you can all take as much time as you want. We got Luke, who is L3D, 3D printer on YouTube, and has a user's guide and a troubleshooting guide for the Ender printers. Pretty decent stuff. And again, Second Amendment advocate for a long, long time. Got Smeggy, who is a snowman and is in California driving right now. Glenn's a barbecue, hosts a show on YouTube a couple times a week, does a 2A Women Wednesday series, as well as a barbecue show on Saturdays, joining us from Pennsylvania. And then Echo is from Florida, who hosts quite a few shows focused on reloading and keeping the community together in live conversations. Let's see, I didn't mention that Luke is up in Oregon or some from Oregon. I don't know where he is right now. And then Rob is Utah. Smeggy's California. I'm in Tucson. And that's about as much as you're going to get from me. So thanks, everybody, for showing up. Feel free to take the mic and let's chat about what our Second Amendment protects for a while.
Sweet. You got a half right. I'm in Oregon now, but I'm from Washington, right across the river.
Oh, okay.
No worries. Half the time when I travel, if people ask where I'm from, I tell them I'm from Portland, Oregon, because everybody knows where that's at. And then they go, oh, I know where that's at. Well, then I go, I actually live across the river in Vancouver, Washington, where the more sane people live. But anyhow.
So again, kind of just threw it out there, but if anybody wants to say, hey, feel free. Otherwise, do we have any topics to lead off with? Anything that's hot on people's minds? I got something, but it has nothing to do with the Second Amendment right now.
All right. I had, the last time I sort of hopped in on one of these, I got some requests about the early development stuff from Every Second Matters. And I am finding stuff as I dig around. I found some of the original proposed artwork and stuff that when I get a chance, I'll share it with the G-Webs and anybody else that wants to play around with it or whatever. But it's a testament to the message that it's still going on, right? Because I was gone for a while for professional reasons, That's turning around, thank God. But I'm glad to see people out doing their thing on the second. I know some people that don't even come and participate here are still doing their own thing on every second matters edict or whatever you want to call it for doing something on the second. And that makes me really happy that it's still going on.
It is. It's kind of cool. It's, you know, gone in different directions. People have taken it. Some people really like the open holster thing and carry around like an empty holster. And some people, you know, do the shirt thing and wear some kind of a gun shirt. So for a long time, there was the get together on the second and just talk about what you did kind of thing. And that lasted, I think, the longest of any like single effort other than just getting together and chatting.
Yeah. Yeah, so I do a mix. Yeah, I guess we could go over what each of us do. I'll let everybody else go first, and then I'll weigh in. How's that?
All right. Yeah, that's something that I do. I try and join in on these chats as often as possible. But even if I don't do that, I really like the grassroots, like coworker, friend of a family type, you know, activism. So I always make it a point on the second to try and shoehorn like Second Amendment into any conversation I'm having, even if that work and, oh man, this pump's messed up, blah, 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 whatever. Blah, blah. I'll be like, oh, that's just like the bump stock ban. And then I'll go on my little soapbox. I have to say, you know, I am behind enemy lines, but almost everyone I work with, when I get talking with them, it's like they're all in the closet, gun owners or supporters or whatever. So I'm very open about it, and hopefully I'm trying to get everyone else a little more comfortable, and maybe some of the people behind enemy lines will realize like they think they're the only person who owns a gun in the whole city or whatever, and they're not. And so maybe with enough people realizing that,
well, when you say that,
they're voting and everything, you know.
When you say that, it makes me think that there's also some effort or some gains to be made by just having people can figure out to calm their jets, right? Once they know a gun owner, maybe they got no interest in owning a gun, but once they know you're a gun owner, they can go, oh, well, then I've been misled that all gun owners are XYZ when this guy's clearly normal. Maybe I can calm down about gun ownership. So that's...
Yeah. Our language can affect that too. So you're quote unquote calling it the enemy lines, right? There is probably at least two-thirds as many people that own guns on the Democrat side as the Republican side, and then throw in a bunch more in the independent or whatever libertarian you want to call it or whatever. But we got to stop phrasing it like that, right? We need to just phrase it people that are either pro-gun or whatever and not put your political affiliation into your gun ownership, you know? Not to lecture you or whatever. Just when you said behind enemy lines or whatever, that creates a barrier that's already there, right? Right at the front of things.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things. Since 2013 to now is when I've been paying the most attention to this stuff, but I've been involved with it since, because I've been a gun owner my whole life and I'm old. So the idea that the talking about it and then the doing stuff, like Smeggy was just kind of doing that with air quotes, because that's such a platitude at this point. The whole behind enemy lines and assuming all political lines make gun ownership lines or something. I think that's something that, well, it's been frustrating over the years, because I've known that people are aware of it, certainly after knowing enough people from California and other states that, you know, I understand I would never say behind enemy lines unless I was doing the air quotes thing also, unless, you know, there's reason for it, just because, you know, I know that there's a lot of competent fight happening over there and lots of successes and victories and stuff. But that's one of those things that, when people come to the mix and the conversations go around, it's going to come up that that concept. But I don't know. I guess I'm saying that over the years, it's certainly become less and less of just a default, let's say it and move on. Because definitely in 2013, we would have said move, right? Or the content, or the the result of that conversation, if someone said, I'm from California and I'm a gun owner, it would have been like, move, and then we would move on to the next conversation.
Yeah. Need to fight for it where you're at, but we shouldn't have to move around the country to have our rights That was why. That's why they were federally enumerated rights, not state given rights. That's all.
I guess I was long way of saying that exactly. Those fights have evolved, and those folks in California aren't just being told like, move or get out of there. It's your fault. Like, keep moving. Those 7 million gun owners in California who united in all kinds of groups and made themselves players.
But yeah, I don't know if saying that you're behind enemy lines is necessarily throwing your political ideologies into it. It's just acknowledging that where you live is not gun friendly, and to say that we're having these awesome victories, we are. But that's because those places are so anti-gun that they're blatantly violating people's rights. And we're getting these victories based on these rights being violated and these laws being unconstitutional. So I think that in itself plays to the behind enemy lines thing, because these people that they have for elected officials, they don't care about the people's rights. And in a sense, you know, if you were, World War II behind enemy lines in Germany, well, if you were working for the Allies, it's not going to be too great, but, you can still score victories. So, I don't know. I guess I just don't see it as throwing in your, political views as much as just substantiating, hey, where I am, it's not a friendly place, but we're trying to change it.
I might have been projecting how I feel about my state on top of you. I apologize for that.
Oh, you didn't bother me. No, I'm just throwing out my ideas here too. That's all. And say, well, yeah, because you got 1639 up there, right?
So, to give people an example of how our education efforts might play a role. A while back, we had the last deal where they turned us into felons for making private party gun sales. It was put up for a public vote, and there was two bills. One was our bill, which said, leave it by the state constitution. We don't have a gun problem. And then the other one was, hey, stop the gun show loophole. People are going to buy guns off the internet and it's unsafe, right? That was their messaging.
Well, he's talking about 1639, I guess, and that was Bloomberg's money came in and bought every marketing company in town, literally, and then told them all, do this message, make this bill happen, and make this ballot initiative happen. So they went out and paid people to sign a ballot initiative, and then once it was on the ballot, they use their marketing stuff, know how to, you know, give people the impression that by signing for it, there'd be safety. And now they're living under the infamy of 1639, right? At least that's my understanding of how it went down.
Well, and with the way I understand it too, I mean, with the way the signature process went and things like that, they're blatantly lying to people to get them to sign. And, you know, even the state Supreme Court there in Washington said, yeah, this is shady and, unconstitutional. And they still let it through.
Very well. Any other topics of the month, topics of the era, topics of the season for Second Amendment? We stuff left off last month, and heading into SHOT Show, and I was in a pretty bad situation going on in my situation over here, so I wasn't really looking forward to a year of 2022. However, after SHOT Show and just the way that things went down and stuff, I've got more optimism than I've had in a while, and then having gone to SHOT Show and had such... Having gone to SHOT Show with a SHOT Show with such presence of Second Amendment stuff, I'm more impressed than ever about what might get done in 2022. I don't know if anybody else got that from any of the reporting or articles that have come out from SHOT Show.
I thought it was a great show. And I can say, at least as far as our project going, it turned out to be amazing. I'm still doing nonstop meetings today, this week, last week, just dealing with SHOT Show leads, which has been really cool.
That's awesome. So Tusk being a cyber and focused on 2A gives us more resource. So it's like having a PayPal or a Venmo or one of these Cash App type of, you know, it's a next or another tool in the inventory to move value around and to create, well, to exchange wealth or exchange value over the web or in real life at gun shows and whatnot, right?
Yeah, it's just a way to... a new way to do commerce that's unstoppable. We can't shut your accounts down if we wanted to. And some people I'd like to, because some people are jerks, but we don't have the ability to do that.
It's definitely cool to see that making gains. That's something that I've been more and more interested in over the years, seeing that the gun community gets some sort of a way to own our value and our... how do we exchange goods and stuff?
All I can say is that people that aren't in the industry, like dealing with, you know, the commerce part, they may not think about, you know, the deplatforming that's going on the financial side. I think a lot more influencers, for instance, seem to recognize there's a problem with the Silicon Valley social media side, because they see that, you know, lots of their friends and stuff are being demonetized or deplatformed or what have you. But there's actually a much bigger financial deplatforming going on that affects the industry. But it's funny, because you hear a lot of FUDs that, you know, start off saying they don't like crypto, but they don't know anything about it, but they don't like it. But understand that the environment we're working in right now with 2A and just maybe even conservative opinions on things, this is not a static environment. I was talking to some people the other day and said, look, the ADL and PayPal are teamed up, and they're doing a research project on how to, quote unquote, cut off hate from their finances. So understand, like, gun people can't use PayPal, right? Understand that you're already not allowed to if you're any, you know, your gun business and a lot of other businesses. But what happened is PayPal gave a lot of money to the ADL to research how they can cut off people from finances. So think about this. Now, I'm not even really a conservative. I'm more of a libertarian. But if you go and look at the ADL's website and look at the articles about how they define racism and how they define hate and things like that, it seems to be a very slippery slope into just normal conservative rhetoric. And so what I think they're building, maybe I'm wrong, but I think they're building a financial no-fly list. So before they were going after industries, I think what you're going to see is they're going to create a list of people that are not allowed to use platforms now. And that's where they're going with this. So understand that this limiting of people's ability to do commerce is coming. And if you're not looking at, or at least considering, decentralized money, and if the industry doesn't get behind it, and look, it doesn't. I know I'm shilling my own project, right? But make it Bitcoin. I don't care. Pick one. If you don't have something that they don't control as a way to do commerce, you're going to be screwed. And that is coming. And so what are you doing about it, or what are people in the industry doing about that fact that that's coming? And then they're like, they look at you like, oh, shit. But they're not paying attention.
Well, here's another thing that I'm going to add, and I've been thinking, because after some of the conversations, just to interrupt you, something that concerns people seem to have when I talk to them about this stuff is the whole investment scam thing. Like on PayPal or like a credit card, I don't invest in my credit card. I don't invest in PayPal. I don't like have a bunch of speculative piles of money on PayPal in case my PayPal money is worth more tomorrow or in the month or something. I just use PayPal as a way to exchange money for things. And I don't put a bunch of money on my credit cards and think, if I have it on my credit cards and then the change in the credit card value goes up, I'm going to be rich. I just use my credit cards. And that's what I'm suggesting Tusk is a useful tool for. If you become rich in the future based on how the world works, awesome. But that's not the goal, right? The goal is just to give us a tool that we can exchange value in a way that's not necessary to have a bank okay it. And then we can move on, you know, have mastered the PayPal, the Venmo, whatever you want to call it, like the next level of banking.
So we never tell people that Tusk is an investment. We never tell people to, quote unquote, invest in Tusk. We never sold it. Understand that. Like, I never sold a bunch of Tusk into the market or whatever. Well, we gave it all away for free. And so let's start with the scam kind of thing, right? There are lots of scams in crypto. No doubt about it. But this comes down to, like, pay attention to what you're doing, learn what you're doing before you make mistakes, get around smart people that can help you walk through and protect yourself from scams. But, you know, I understand, I can't sell you. I never sold anything. So, like, I didn't take anybody's money. And we've been around 4 years now. It's like, we're not like some kind of new thing that we're trying to just come to the market and take advantage of gun people or anything like that. We started talking to the gun industry about 2.5 years ago. But I'm doxed, our team's doxed, you know, we're not hiding, we're not like, you know, furry cartoon avatars, you know, trying to pitch some get rich quick scheme. So we're kind of different. So I look at it like this. There's some people that look like they're a little more close to my age here. So, you know, remember that back during the .com, you know, bust era. Like before the .com crash, right, there was all these, there's a zillion IPO stocks of internet companies that were coming around, and they were all just, there were so many of those out there. And there were lots of scams then too, remember? And then most of them failed. Most of them were garbage. Most of them were, you know, riding a hype wave. But out of that, you have Amazon.com blew up. You got Facebook. You got Google. Microsoft blew up. You got the Twitters of the world and a lot of other tech companies that capitalized on the technology, which under the technology that underlies cryptocurrencies and NFTs is absolutely stunning and amazing and allows for amazing potential in a lot of different areas. But we're going through that kind of hype cycle, which leads to a lot of people are coming here just to get rich quick because it's exciting. A lot of people come here because they're afraid of the dollar collapsing, which I think is a genuine concern at this point. And where I kind of come at it is, you know, I'm old too. And I come at it from the point of view is that I do have a good understanding of the technology now, but I'm good at applying it and saying, okay, this technology will be really good for this industry. And so we've never marketed our project as an investment. We've never hyped it like, oh, it's going to go to the moon, Lambo kind of stuff. We've always said, look, we're trying to solve this problem in this industry because we care about this industry. And I think that's like a big difference is how we're approaching it. Now, it's funny because the fact that we're so focused on trying to solve real problems and we haven't hyped, then people are like, oh, well, you don't got much volume on your blockchain and you're not worth $10 billion. So it's like a weird trade-off, right? You can't make everybody happy. I'm like, well, I just tell people, look, it's a free floating price, much like gold. Like if you're going to buy gold or silver, precious metals, by the way, I like precious metals too. But if you're going to go buy gold or silver, when you go in, the price is never the same. It's always changing because it's a market priced commodity. Well, Tusk is as well. And so just understand it's a little different than, you know, PayPal or Venmo in that aspect. But we think that this industry, the gun industry, is definitely under attack and going to continue to be. And we believe they're going to be going after the industry harder through the financial sectors that are all run by folks in Silicon Valley that hate us. And so we think it's just, if anything, it's a free insurance policy. It doesn't cost you anything to set up Tusk. It doesn't cost you to set up a payment gateway. It's free. You can set up a wallet. It's free. There's 0% transaction fees for retailers. It's less than a penny for a buyer to send any kind of transactions. So, I mean, it's stupid cheap. It's pretty straightforward and easy to set up, and it's an insurance policy. So if your current payment methods seem to go belly up or get wonky because of politics, you still have Tusk as a backup.
We'll be adding it to the to our Gear website store, and then, you know, making things that cost like $10 or whatever be, you know, available for Tusk, or $20 or whatever. So you'll be able to go put $25 in a wallet and then turn that into the kind of cyber coin you want. That could be Tusk, and then go to a store and use it like a PayPal or whatever and see what we're talking about, because that's really all it is figuring, getting people comfortable with using the new PayPal or the new system so that they can experience it, and then we're not confused or hindered by it. But I was going to say also that it's very much like when people want to have their videos on different platforms nowadays because they're concerned about issues, or they just like the idea of exploring new platforms or having different conversations with different rules of terms of service and things on the different platforms. So it's the same way except with money, right? With being able to exchange value on an alternative platform. All right, well, so you said you were having success or having a lot of leads from SHOT or whatever. I'm glad, because again, that means that even if people don't wrap it up right away and end up having Tusk available on their whatever, their storefront or whatever it is you're talking to, at least it's in their heads and they're getting comfortable with the concept. And I'm sure some of them are going to come through. Like I say, I just need the time to go do it. And by the end of the week, I should have Tusk available as an option on the store.
And by the way, I didn't pay him to say that either.
No, I'm just glad that I figured out how to do it. Thanks to, you know, kind of making the process understandable. Then that's something I've been wanting to do for a bit.
Yeah, and if you need any help, you know, I'll help you out. I mean, I think I always tell people, like, Tusk, you know, and we're a decentralized project, but that's just a big fancy term to say we're somewhere between a cross between a nonprofit and like a co-op. So, like, there's no, you know, C Corp. I'm not a CEO or anything like that. You know, we all got day jobs, and this is just something that we are doing because we think it's needed. I mean, that's what it comes down to. But what else you got? I think out there, and, you know, it's funny, like, in, you know, GWebs, we talked a lot at SHOT Show, and it's like, who else is out here trying to help this sector, this industry, like, with crypto or anything, right? Like, and no one. There's no one out. There's no one from any other crypto there. And I think that that's the difference, is that we're trying to do the work for, to really kind of, you know, get people, you know, comfortable, but understanding that there is this option out there in, just in case things go south. And that's just kind of how I've just tried to work with people. And I get a lot of people don't like new things. A lot of people don't like change. But the fact is, the industry is changing and the politics are not getting better, regardless of, you know, we might have some wins out there and certain, you know, lawsuits and stuff put out by the big gun rights people. But the fact is, the industry is not getting freer when it comes to the financial piece. And there needs to be something out there for people to fall back on.
You're focusing on the firearms industry, but, and I'm sorry, I'm just kind of joining in, but you're focusing on the firearms industry. Do you want to, or are you looking at expanding beyond just the firearms industry?
Hey, Jeff, actually, we were never only going to be for the firearms industry. So that was never, that's not the rhetoric, right? So Tusk, the name is the universal settlement coin. So the long-term plan was always to be a universally adopted crypto payment system. But what we've said is that in the United States, if you want to get adoption for crypto, you have to start with industries that have a recognized problem with payments. And in the U.S., there's about 7 industries that have kind of meet that criteria, and they're all distasteful to somebody, all of them. So it's things like pornography, gambling, cannabis, CBD, payday lenders, multi-level marketing. Oh, and guns, right? So, but I am a gun guy, and I'm not a carpetbagger, but in this space for a long time. I had a business in this space. I ran for Congress in 2006, and my voter questions on, you know, the gun thing were, you know, pretty damn pure back in, you know, 12 years ago. So this is brief. If you guys want to do some research, just Google my name. I'm pretty easy to find info about. No, the fact is, we've always wanted to work outside the gun industry. And that's always the plan. In fact, we have several different players that we're talking to that are looking to integrate us that are not in the gun space. So guns were the starting point, just like Amazon started as a bookstore. But to me, it seemed like the best industry. One, I'm passionate about the industry. So let's start there. I like guns. I know guns. I get guns. I build guns. But it's a $50 billion industry. They have really big problems. They can't use third-party payment systems for the most part. They have a huge, you know, the private builders and guns have a big chargeback problem. They pay high credit card, you know, fees when they can get the processing. And of all those distasteful industries I listed, really, they're the only ones that are explicit. Guns are the one that's, you know, explicitly protected by the Constitution. So to me, that seemed like a much safer place to spend my time and something I'm more interested in. And so that's why we decided to go into the gun industry. We may never leave it, but I can tell you we already, I mean, I know there's a CBD shop that already takes it up in Wisconsin, that already takes Tusk. So, I mean, we do talk to other industries and remember, Tusk will work for anything, but the gun industry is just where I'm focused my time. And if someone else was very, passionate about one of those other sectors and they wanted to go around and go to those conferences and spend time trying to onboard, companies in a different sector, they could absolutely do that. I choose to spend my time focusing on the 2A space. And most of us on the project were already weird gun nerds anyway. So it just kind of made sense for us to start here. And that's where we are.
I was looking at your stuff just a couple of days ago, again. And it's like you said, part of the challenge is the capitalization rates. You know, if you go and look on the currency exchanges and stuff, you're not really listed. You're because you're below their threshold of visibility. I guess the big question for anybody is, what about risk? What is the risk profile in investing in this product?
So I'll tell you, so our normal market cap is for most of last year was between 4 and 6 million. We did a massive network upgrade last fall. And when we came back, so it's called a hard fork. When a crypto network actually upgrades, it's called a fork. And the biggest volume exchange we were on, most of the exchanges we're on are Chinese or foreign. And the biggest exchange we're on that most of our volume up until that point, we were at thousands a day in volume, and we were tracked on CoinMarketCap and CoinGecko. What ended up happening is this shady exchange called Probit said, we're not going to upgrade our node unless you give us $50,000. We don't have $50,000. Well, we're not going to update your node and upgrade to the new hard fork. And so that got very contentious. And what's happening is it killed a lot of our volume, which resulted in a listing being delisted from CoinMarketCap. So that's what happened. Like, they tried to blackmail us, and we wouldn't pay it even if we had it, which we don't. So I always say the best tracker to track us on is nomics.com or coinpaprika.com, and they do look at our market cap and fill that out. So it's interesting. One of the things that we're doing right now, we have two more exchange listings already queued. We're talking to two big American fiat exchanges right now. And then in our group, we're actually passing the hat to get on a DEX that also has access to liquidity pools, which we never did before. And we're already looking at another liquidity pool option to do a wrapped Tusk on the Ethereum blockchain to get into Uniswap. So we are going to be working on that. It's just part of getting out there.
All right. I appreciate your answering the question, but this would be like if we had went into a crazy amount of like the Ogilvy like grind on a neck of a reloading issue, and we went off on that kind of subject. So I'm going to rein us back in. So it's not designed to be an investment thing. So yeah, it doesn't have a setup to make it a big investment lucrative thing, right? So we'll have Rob on. Rob's going to be on with Clover, and there's going to be plenty of opportunity for people to talk about Tusk specific questions. But since this is Every Second Matters, and ideally people are showing up to talk about Second Amendment awareness and what Second Amendment protects, let's talk about what Tusk, the concept, will protect in the industry. And specific questions about it, I understand they're just going to get crazy. But the same way if we asked Echo to tell us about, you know, something about the angle of the shoulder on something, he'd go nuts and DJ us for hours on that angle. So I'm just going to try to stop it because people are going to roll their eyes and go, oh, I don't understand. And it pisses me off as a technical person and someone who's capable, and I'm older than all of you. It's so easy to understand what Rob's talking about. But just as soon as he started talking about all that stuff, trying to justify a investment angle of cyber, none of that is, he just got done talking about how that's not what Tusk is about. Tusk will evolve to be whatever it is because it's a dollar. A dollar isn't pro-gun. A dollar isn't anti-gun. A dollar is a dollar. there was a credit card, there's a traveler's check, there's PayPal, there's also going to be cyber, and then there'll be stuff that we don't know about yet. We can either be aware of that next step, or we can be scared and take whatever's given to us when everyone else takes the next step first. So no one's going to ask anybody to invest anything more than $25, because if you think that you need to invest money, then you're not listening. This is just a tool. You don't have to invest a bunch of money to become a gunsmith if you want to fix your AR, right? When none of us get so scared about becoming a gunsmith that we don't even try to fix our guns in front of us. So, I don't know. I'm just trying to stop a bunch of people rolling their eyes out there when we start talking about the nuts and bolts of it. So I apologize if that was out of line, but, you know, trying to keep it on Second Amendment awareness.
All good.
But anyway, so Jeff's in here. Jeff is going to be at the 2A rally here in Arizona on the 19th of February. Any chance you're going to drive down for that, Rob? Is it on your radar?
Probably not. When is it? What is it?
So every year in Arizona, we have one rally, at least one large rally at the state capitol on the grounds of the state capitol. And that'll be on the 19th of February. It's a Saturday. I don't know if anybody did invite you, but since we're sitting here talking about it.
No, I checked my calendar. I'd be happy to check my calendar. I know I'm going to be the end of that week. I'm going to be up in Wyoming for a while, but let me check. Maybe it's in the cards.
It is a pretty neat event, and there will be folks there that are, well, paying attention to the Second Amendment stuff. I don't know if it's worth the drive down or not. Jeff might be able to chime in on that.
Well, you're invited. I don't, you know, there's quite a few booths. There's quite a few people. We've got some great keynote speakers. So, you know, love to have you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. Speaking of that, who is going to be down there? I'm assuming you're going to be down there, G, and we got anybody else in the listenership or in the chat room who's planning to make the trip?
I don't think so. Let's see who we got out there. DJ's up in Nebraska. I asked him, actually, if he's going to drive down, but evidently his car doesn't have that kind of drive in it. Foss is up in Washington State also, so he's probably not coming down. And Luke is working, right? So you're not taking no drives like that. Where's Weston at? Does anybody know? I'm trying to think. I know it's east of here. Sandhills is also up in Nebraska. Gizzard's in Kansas. He refuses to make a long drive just for 2A rally. It's his work. And I think that's everybody. Echo's out in Florida. While everybody else is in here.
What kind of turnout do you normally get at that 2A rally? Is it encouraging? Get some good numbers?
The last couple of years, we've been around 2,500 to 3,500, I think, if I remember right.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's definitely getting bigger each year. I've asked them to ask the police that are up on the roof of the building to take a picture down at us so that we can take a count, because we could literally count how many heads are down there. That's what I usually do. But it's so many people that it would be very difficult to get a still image of everybody to count, because it swarms all around the both grasses at this point. And
yeah, they spread out too far.
But it's pretty awesome. I mean, it is 100% 2A, and it's not like, hey, let's have a rally and call it 2A, but it's really a this or it's really a that. I mean, there are motorcycles there, but I mean, they're not really the centerpiece. They just happen to have a bunch of people show up on their motorcycles and they park them right on the street there. But it's 100% 2A. All the talk is insightful, and it's not like, pandering, like political stuff. Like, it's, you know, some of it gets into it and brings up ideas that people haven't thought about before. It's a pretty good diverse group of speakers, and it's from 10 to 4 or 10 to 2, so it's 4 hours, right?
Right. Yeah. And Cheryl Todd always puts it together. And as far as finding speakers and doing all of the legwork, Cheryl and Kim. And so they always do a great job, and really, you know, it's an energizing event. It really is.
I mean, I've been to a lot of 2A rallies and state rallies, and yeah, it's as well produced a rally as their podcast is. So very well produced and like effective. It's efficient. There's people talking the whole time. You can hear them. There's booths. There's entertainment. They have it all covered. There's places for the kids, parking. I mean, you can't create parking out of nowhere, but aside from the issue with the stupid parking lots being messed up with last year, compared to other rallies I've been to, again, just like literally about the best. And there's food. So, I mean, literally the best. You don't even have, you could show up and have not just a good time, but like really enjoy yourself, have like decent food, not like, oh, I can eat some kind of bag of chips or something. It's like food truck food. So yeah, we definitely.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And I expect to be there from about 7:30 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. And maybe I'll actually get to eat this time. I don't know. I think Chris Cheng is our keynote speaker, but we've got folks from all over the place.
So he's probably lives by Smeggy, so Smeg can just get a ride.
There you go.
Yeah, just have him come swing by. That'd be a fun road trip.
Be like, you got to have the AC on really high. He starts to melt all over. All right, so we've got people out there and joining, saying hey. And I don't know, like we don't really have, I know I never had any kind of super tradition for every second matters. I usually adapted to whatever's at the time, but again, it's been going on for quite a few years now. So is it about to be 10 years? Next year, it'll be 10 years every second matter's been around. So over that time, people have had different types of things to do. One of them, I think I alluded to it earlier, was for people talk about what they did. If they did something specifically for every second matters, either today or throughout the month. Does anybody want to bring any of that up? Or if anybody out there is listening and wants to bring that stuff up, feel free, we can highlight it or whatever.
All right, before I sabotage my phone again, sorry for that, I was in the middle of telling a story and I overheated my phone and got kicked out when my phone cooled down. So for me, being a federal contractor currently, I can't wear a gun on the second, but I did get permission from my federal boss to wear an empty holster, and so that's what I would generally do. On the rare occasion that I'm home on the second and I'm not working, then I would open carry. I would say that's less of an event in that when I'm home, I open carry all the time. I know everybody has their own opinion on that, and I don't want to argue that today, but anyhow, that's sort of what I do. It's amazing how many people that I run into, whether it's the second or any other time that I open carry, that I get to educate them on our state laws on who can own guns, who can carry a gun, you have to have a concealed carry permit, all that kind of stuff. So I find it a real useful tool. But later on, some other chat, we can get into specific things you should do if you're open carrying. I carry a backup gun and other stuff, but whatever. So those are types of activities I try and work in on the second when I can.
DJ is one of the people that currently does the open carry and empty holster so that basically people see it and then make a comment. I think he'll sometimes put something in there, right, Barbecue?
Yeah, I think he's mentioned putting in the Every Second Matter business cards, or perhaps it was a paper gun. I don't remember exactly 100%.
But man, like a paper constitution or a pocket constitution or something, maybe?
perhaps, you know, just something else to help draw attention there. But I'm with Luke. I open carry constantly. When I'm going out, I'm open carrying unless I'm going to a place that specifically says, hey, we don't want you to be open carrying in our establishment for some reason, which rarely do I run into anything like that. But yeah, Luke, I would love to have that conversation with you sometime. That'd be great.
I'd love to do it. I got a mute because of what I'm doing with my stuff.
So DJ's out there bragging about Nebraska could become 22nd for constitutional carry. Any theories or any ideas on how that'll go down this year? Or is this not the year to see, what is it, like 5 or 6 new constitutional carries? Are we about to get into the 30s?
It'd be nice if we could. I mean, Ohio's on the cusp, but, you know, with what we keep hearing from TMONT, who knows what to think about that. But I would like to think that here within the next couple months, they're going to make that move and seal the deal. Likewise, then we got, what, 5 or 6 more states on cue this year, which if Ohio gets it done, then I guess that would take us to 28 if we got 6 more on cue this year. Likewise, though, depending on how Pennsylvania's primaries go this election cycle, then we very well could see Pennsylvania hopefully making another push at it if we can manage to get a Republican governor. Most likely, our House and Senate will remain Republican-controlled. And we already passed it through the House and Senate once, so we should have no problem doing the same again. And if we've got a favorable governor, you know, we could even see ourselves getting back into the mix in 2023.
Yeah, I really think the tipping point is coming up on constitutional carry, because we all know, we hear about the Wild West, blood in the streets, blah, 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 every single time. Well, if we have 26, 27 states that have it, when we have hard evidence, like you can look at the data, did crime spike, did it drop, did it stay the same, did whatever, and you have all this huge sample size, our argument just keeps getting easier and easier, because it's, look at all these places that have it, have had it for 10 years, have had it for 5 years, had it 1 year, like however long, and nothing bad's happening. So there's no reason not to have it.
So do we see, because I think we'll have to push 30, 35 before we see it on the national level again being pushed for. Well, that was, heck, that was only national reciprocity. That wasn't even constitutional carry nationally. But
we need it. I don't want to even see it. If we get 30 states, then we'll just let the states continue to do it. I don't want to see a push for national level, give the government extra rights that it doesn't have.
I don't think it's really giving the government extra rights. It's just an affirmation of our rights that we don't need silly permits and cards to carry and travel from state to state and worry about reciprocity and things like that.
Giving the federal government level of authority to dictate that is something that they don't already have. I'm not going to give them that so that we can have it. Just don't even, they should know, they don't deserve it. They don't need it. It's not necessary.
So
it's
Second Amendment state level issue or a federal issue?
Both. You can't have constitutional carry without national reciprocity?
No. I'm not saying national reciprocity. I would like to see national reciprocity not even be in the conversation. I'd like to see it be constitutional carry, period, across, you know, nationally. No more carry permits or anything. That's what I was getting at was...
Well, then we're saying the same thing. So then,
yeah.
If that's the case, then is that what we're going to see this year, is just more of the same? Like you say, I can't imagine anyone is going to be able to come up with some new argument on the anti side that says, oh, even though 21 states have it, some of them now for a decade,
here's why it's actually bad, and that's a decent argument that a lot of people start to, you know what I mean? Like, I don't see that happening, right? So shouldn't we just see a good chunk of all these states go constitutional carry also?
Well, that's what I was trying to get at, is if we do see that, could we see more of a wave? But then do we get to a point where, let's say we have 40 states that are doing constitutional carry, do those other 10 say, hey, you want to do that? Have at it, but leave us alone and let us do our thing where we're infringing on everybody's rights. And then we just have, you know, 10 states that, as a firearms owner, you want to avoid. You know, is that something that we could see happen as well, if we don't have a national level push at some point?
Well, the problem with any national level push is that you're giving the federal government the right to tell the states what they can and can't control. And of course, with the Second Amendment, you want to say, no, this falls under federal purview, but that's going to happen through the courts. It's going to have to happen through the courts, because, you know, since we rewrote the Second Amendment and all that and redefined everything here in the last couple of years, the way the justices and the founders used to talk about it, we keep going around in circles on this. I don't think it's an argument that we need to have with each other, especially not in advance of actually getting there. The question on national reciprocity, that's an argument that we can discuss at some point. As far as constitutional carry, I think we just keep driving. Every state that adopts constitutional carry is just one more nail in the coffin, one more proof that the nonsense that the opposition spouts is nonsense. And it kills me the way each state, the opposition comes in and says, oh, it's dangerous to police officers. It's going to be blood in the streets. It's going back to the wild, wild west and so forth and so on. And it's like, well, we've heard these arguments from the last 20 states that did this. Why, you know, and it's never come true. I'm actually really surprised that they haven't been trying harder to blame us for the increase in murders over the last 2 years, while they were defunding the police and letting everybody out on free bail.
Well, in an era when they could have just taken statistics and then interpreted them and then had something printed and then used that to point at in a press conference or something, and then, you know, to confront that or to challenge that, you would have had to done epic amount of work. You know, that's different now when they can put something up on the web and we can take the data and find it and then figure out how they interpreted what and challenge them, you know, in a much more effective way. So I think that some of that depended on everybody phoning it in. And again, I'll default to the people who are dealing with the horrible of most infringement laws with the most infringement while they watch their neighbors do whatever they want, perceivably. You know, people that grew up like that or living like that, they're not going to tolerate the, you know, let's just phone it in or let's just point at these charts that we made earlier. Like, they're going to demand that, like you say, that they follow up with, and they haven't come up with a better idea, a challenge to constitutional carry than blood in the streets and all that. And that's, again, they're just phoning it in. And I think watching Texas have that happen and it effectively, you know, going through fairly handily, that was a good, I don't know, what's the word, like, premonition of what should happen this year.
We can hope so. There's several governors that I don't trust. And I think that they'll try and figure out ways to kill it back door so that they can avoid having to veto it. DeWine in Ohio in particular. But, you know, who knows? We just got to keep pushing it. And that brings up the other question is here we are in 2022. Where should we be driving? Where should the Second Amendment policy be going? What should we as activists and advocates be focusing on? I just submitted a column to Firearms News. One of the trends that I've been seeing that bothers me, and it doesn't answer my initial question on where we should be going, but it's more of a where we shouldn't be going, is we shouldn't be chasing the communist cancel culture, doing things the way the other side does them. The infighting within the movement, I've seen a whole lot more purity test and if you're not 100% on the same page that I'm on, then you're the enemy. Not only are you the enemy, you're evil. And I've been seeing that more and more within our community. And I'm afraid that that's destructive and harmful. A little bit of chastising, some correcting, some arguing, I'm all in favor of that. But labeling people that aren't 100% in the same camp that I'm in, but are 90% with me, I'll take the 90% and I'll try and educate that extra 10.
Yes.
Can I segue into the education thing a little bit?
I pay attention to a lot of stuff and I don't see that at all. So I don't know where you're seeing a lot of that, or I don't know if you want to talk, go into any kind of details, but I mean, that element has been around, but I think we're never going to be all united. That's unrealistic. We've got extremes like the liberal gun club on one side and then Trump supporters on the other side. And they're never going to, that's oil and water. Like, they're never going to mix. And to wait until they're united, that's, you know what I'm saying? I don't think that's what you're saying. So,
G-Webs, can I put a point in right in the middle of that I think makes sense?
Sure.
So, and I am going back to the story I told earlier, but it points right at this. We had that two competing deals. One said keep constitutional carry. The other one says make you a felon if you sell firearms without going through an FFL, right? We had 85% of the people that voted the law that got us screwed for having to do that also voted for the keep it the same. And it was all because we didn't educate them on what the bills meant. And we have to get together on our messaging, take the red and the blue out of it, and educate them. Because once you close that voting room curtain, ain't nobody looking over your shoulder. Some of these people that in a group of people will denounce gun ownership and, oh, the black rifles and all that crap, they own an arsenal of guns and they're voters, right? So however we can come around to taking this political lines out of it, and just general education, even for the general public, for the people that don't own guns, they just know they have an uncle that has a gun or a buddy has a gun and they don't really care. If we can get a concise and non-aggressive message to them, we win the race. I mean, 15% was nothing in that election. Hell, if half or 10% of the Republicans registered to vote went and voted, we'd have won it. But that's a whole nother story. But we need to totally depoliticize the camps in our community for advancing the message about gun ownership is not evil. It is not a problem. That's what I wanted to get out. Thank you.
I like the idea of what are we going to do as a direction or whatever, because as far as, well, I don't like the idea of getting behind constitutional carry and being like, there's a thing and it's positive, we're done. Now let's go worry about what grip angles we're going to buy on the next model of Wonder 9 or whatever. So I'd rather see people working on many fronts and getting used to being, working instead of just reacting. And that's where I thought you were going, Jeff. So as far as other objectives for 2022, as far as Second Amendment advocates and people that want to do something with their time and effort and their resources, what about the responses from those comment periods? We're expecting to see the
the ATF's, like, whatever, however they're going to react to the definition of receivers, and then the pistol braces, and both of those could have consequences to how we deal with, you know, either AR pistols or whatever the other stuff is going to end up being, 80 percenters and that kind of thing. And are we going to wait and react, or is any kind of national level leadership going to come up and give us some options so that we can prepare and get ready? Is having a resistance something that would help the ATF determine which way they're going to go? Or are they looking at this as rolling up their sleeves and getting ready to pummel some jello again because they don't know how we're going to react? Like, is that an effort that's even worth putting stuff into? Am I missing something else on the radar? But I'm ready to see Second Amendment advocacy be something that people are proactive about and come together with ideas. Same way the 3D printers, they don't sit around waiting for someone to tell them what to print. They got their printers and they start printing. And then they start making 3D makers matches and doing stuff, right? I want to see Second Amendment advocacy call some shots and collaborate or challenge each other on how we accomplish some goals and some tasks. And is that worth doing? I'll shut up.
So that's where I was going to say, I'd like to see us driving towards what, before you even mentioned the comment period, G was, that's what I was going to bring up, is with the pistol brace comment period, you know, they came up with this ridiculous score sheet, which it sounds like their full intent is going to be to go through with that in August. And with that score sheet, they say, if we feel like you're still trying to circumvent the NFA or GCA, we can still deem this firearm a short-barreled rifle or short-barreled shotgun. So right there, we have a mission from the ATF that really these are just workarounds with these braces. And if it's, you know, a pistol with a brace, it really is just an SBR or SBS. And I really think the ATF has stepped in it and they don't realize it. And that's something that we should be harnessing in on and going after full stead, saying, you know what, these things are on the NFA. They require a $200 tax stamp. There's millions of them on the market now. And the ATF is saying, yeah, these are indeed just a workaround. They are really SBRs or SBSs. So we've got millions of them on the streets, but there's nothing being done with them. And get those knocked off the NFA. And if we can do that, I mean, think about how that could just make the rest of it crumble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we need to target that. It's one of the stupider laws that's on the books, the whole short-barreled rifle, short-barreled shotgun, especially with the, I hate to use the term, loopholes that the ATF has allowed to you know, promulgate in the last you know, couple of decades. It's silly. It's nonsense. And if most people understood what it really amounts to, and the example I love to use is the mayor's leg, the old Steve McQueen's little short-barreled Model 92, he was actually arrested in New York when he was doing Wanted Dead or Alive because he showed up with that little rifle, and they brought him up on federal charges. It cost the studio about $10,000 to get the paperwork done on it retroactively as a short-barreled rifle. But of course, you can buy one from, who is it, Rossi or Cimarron or somebody, that looks exactly like it, but on the piece of paper, when they made the thing, they referenced it as a pistol instead of as a rifle. And so it's completely legal. And when people see things like that, it hopefully makes a light bulb go off in their heads. But my big push, and it's been a push for several years, and I can't get any traction with it, or haven't been able to get any traction with it so far, is that you've got people that are really concerned about the short-barreled rifle issue. You've got people who are really concerned about suppressors and want to see silencers deregulated. You've got people who are really concerned about constitutional carry, and they focus there. You've got people who are really focused on the sanctuary movement. You've got people who are really focused on national reciprocity. Again, arguments there. All of these different things, if you look historically at the gun rights movement, the moment that the gun rights movement was at its peak, the moment that we were the strongest, the moment that we were accomplishing the most, was during the period that we were pursuing the Firearms Owners Protection Act. And my belief is that the reason for that is that FOPA had enough of interest to enough different people to attract a big army to it, some people favoring different components within the framework. And it, as we marched, I compare it to Sherman marching to the sea. As we marched, we would go off and do skirmishes left and right as they popped up, but we were moving towards a common goal. The goal was multiplicity. There were multiple goals in that goal, but we were able to build an army to do that. We don't have to all agree on every detail, but as long as there's something in it that we do that each of us agrees with, we can hopefully get people behind it. And that's what I think is the direction that we can go and should go is, yes, you do individual bills for each of the things that you want, but you also, you package it all up in an omnibus bill that this is our flagship. This is what we're really shooting for, and march that forward and let people rally around that and build that gun voter base back up, build that unanimous consent,
right?
Back
up.
Got
all these new gun owners, and they're already voters because everyone's a voter nowadays. So these are new people who grew up with smartphones and Amazon, and they're aware, and they became gun owners intentionally, not because they got them from their grandpa.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a choice. So,
right.
You know, and
so can I take a second? When you're talking about the Firearms Owners Protection Act, this is 1968. So before, I'm sure everybody's time sits before my time. So
1986.
Oh, sorry, 1986. I'm thinking 1968. Okay, so 1986, we're talking the Firearms Owners Protection Act, and everybody only thinks about the Hughes Amendment, which is horrible, and it stopped the
right.
Transferable machine guns. But what we're actually talking about is since 1968, until 1986, that time frame, you know, if you bought ammunition at a gun shop, you had to write your name and address on a piece of paper that the next person saw your name and address on that piece of paper, and the next person saw your name and address on that piece of paper. So if you're a woman trying to buy a box of ammo, your name and address is on a piece of paper at a gun shop that the next person is going to see it, and the next person. And that is the kind of tyranny we lived in because of the 1968. And that's just one piece, but that kind of tyranny, that infringement was enough to just make people want to spit, right? And so that's the kind of stuff that we lived with in the 1986 Gun Owners Protection Act removed some of that. It did some stuff where it stopped the ATF from being able to harass FFL so that gun shops weren't stressed out and freaked out and had to basically be able to work with a bureaucracy in order to exist, right? They had to, you know, the gun shops had to be jerks back in the day because the bureaucracy was so horrible that you had to be able to withstand that. So you had to come from like the military or something where you were going to stand up to that grind, right? So when you remove the ATF's ability to do that, there was some incentive, like you're saying, right? There was a bunch of stuff that the Firearms Owners Protection Act did. That's why it's called that. So we have similar tyrannies now. It's just that we're either so used to the burden or we're not under it ourselves, our neighbors are, that we're not paying attention to it. But we've got, I think, a similar infringement and tyranny that we can that we are rallying against, right? We've got that. And I think what you're also saying in that time frame, it was a bunch of different interests came together and gathered their bills that were different but similar into one omnibus bill.
And then that could be pushed by everybody. Everybody had something to grab onto and push. Obviously, we wouldn't allow a Hughes Amendment. And one of the big elements might be to remove the Hughes Amendment, right, in something going forward. But is that a good summary so that people know what we're talking about?
Pretty much. The big thing that's missing is that the Firearms Owners Protection Act, it was originally, Dad called it the Gun Decontrol Act. In 1977, when we turned over NRA, when NRA was trying to get out of the gun lobby business, and we, the members, went in and said, no, we're going to get you deeper into the gun lobby business, quit hiding from it, go out and embrace it. And so we changed things at NRA in 77. In 78, they hired Dad to run ILA. And when Dad went to Washington, he went with the Gun Decontrol Act scribbled down on a yellow notepad. And that was his agenda going in. So from 1978 to 1986, the gun rights movement was pretty solidly unified behind what became the Firearms Owners Protection Act. And even though those who know the history know that after 1982, between 1982 and 1986, there was a whole lot of turmoil within our community and leaders fighting amongst themselves. Still, the focus of the average guy on the street was passing the Firearms Owners Protection Act, and we kept pushing it, and finally, in 86, they watered it down a little bit more, and they got the vote. They pushed it out onto the floor, and eventually it passed, but unfortunately with the Stinking Hughes Amendment attached to it. And that's what we got. But our laws were almost as bad as California's. Our federal laws were almost as bad as most of California's laws are today back then. And so there's been a sea change. You couldn't buy ammo or even components through the mail in 1978. You had to fill out the register at the gun store to buy 22 ammo, any ammo. You had to fill out their book. There just was a ton of things. And actually, a lot of those things,
right? You couldn't travel.
No, traveling, if you were going from Maine to Virginia, you were screwed. I mean, there was like, you just, there was no protection for going through a restricted zone. And actually, New Jersey, a judge in New Jersey ruled that an NRA sticker on the window of a car was probable cause for a state trooper to pull the car over and search it for firearms. That's how terrible everything was at that time. No protections for travel, none of that stuff. And so the Firearms Owners Protection Act did a lot of good, and we got the Hughes Amendment. And just like the Hughes Amendment was whittling away at this border area, so too is the stuff about bump stocks, the pistol braces, the auto reset triggers. It's, well, there's only a narrow segment of the gun rights or the gun owner population that really cares about these things. And so we can slice them off. And if we, the mass of the gun rights movement, don't stand up and say no for all of that. We passed at a gun rights policy conference many years ago. We called it the farmer policy or protocol. It was just that any gun is every gun, that we, the rights movement, pledge to stand behind and stop anything that is encroaching on any part of our rights, even if it's not our part. And I think that's critical that we all get there, but it's really hard to do. So my idea and my push, I'd like to see an omnibus that can bring us all together under one flag that we want to push this bill. And in the end, maybe it'll get watered down. Maybe we'll lose some of the parts and pieces of that bill when it really comes to a vote. But if we get a lot of it, or even some of it, it's a win. And we come back next year with the rest and keep marching.
And having learned how to fight and having some experience, and I think there's something to be said for that. It's a bunch of, for years now, I can't tell you how many times I've heard a bunch of blowhards say about how we should be and how back in my day we woulda. And, we need opportunities to put your money where your mouth is and work together instead of just we should be working together. So I think there'd be no matter how successful it is, there's that residual or extra benefit.
So real quick, if I can jump in, I'm about to drop out of here, but I'll be listening. So I'd like to open up, if any of you guys have any ideas, brainstorming on, this is going to be my focus for 22, is how do we stop the ATF from doing all of the redefinition stuff? I mean, pick your poison of which one they've done recently, but I personally don't know how to fight that. And so I'm open to any suggestions. And
that goes to a bigger problem. The general public has ceded to allow the government to let the alphabet soup agencies create law, which they were never to create law. And I don't know that we can get the gun community on board to try and fix that. But you see it from ATF, but you also see it from the storm, what is the one for environmental and EPA? The EPA is writing its own laws, making people criminals without even the law, the stuff being run through Congress.
And EPA, OSHA, Department of Energy, Department of Education.
They've all become able to all of a sudden create their own law on their own without oversight from Congress. And that's a whole standalone issue and a very valid one for sure. But that's another fight to take on for sure.
Well, no, but I think that's one of the things that I see firearms being so integral and so have such potential, because that is a danger of the way the checks and balances are being used or being checked and balanced right now. But if we see an infringement so obvious and the NFA, and start thinking about all the stuff just from SHOT Show this year that's AOW, versus some destructive device stuff, I guess. And then, of course, short barrel rifles and shotguns, and then suppressors, which are really just hearing protection or American disabilities and all that. So we have so many angles to take out the NFA. And then one of those angles or one of those tools to take it down is the idea that, I forget what it's called, when the Congress lets the executive branch make laws by action or whatever that's called.
They've abdicated their power.
Right. So if we go after them and hold them to task for the gun arena or element or realm of society, that leads the way for the other areas of society to either get their stuff together, follow our recipe, or for the bureaucracy to go, people are figuring it out, and then they are figuring out ways to resist this and to stop it. So we got to, basically see new politicians come in, new representatives that aren't there to have the established status quo, but instead come in and fix things. And that's what'll happen. As soon as there's a taste for a change, we're going to see them change their marketing and change because they're greedy and they want their jobs, or the next version of them will want their jobs and they're going to want to do what we want them to do. So I think there's a lot of gain to be made by being the ones that lead the way.
Is there a version of this where we co-opt non-gun related things that have had agencies create laws that don't belong, and the general public may not be happy about, where we could package it all up together to point out the problem.
Well, it's all on
people that are outside of our problem helping with our problem.
This all interstate commerce. Is that too big a thing to say, hey, let's just attack the interstate commerce and then that kills the NFA?
Wouldn't that be fun?
Unopened as a special.
From my perspective, I look at it that you it's an opportunity for us to gain allies. The administrative state is a huge problem. The abdication of congressional authority to the administrative state is a massive problem. It's a specific problem within our community, most particularly regarding the ATF, but also several other agencies, including the DEA and Customs and a couple of others. But I think by us focusing in on the abuses of the ATF in particular and our cause, we can bring in the other organizations that are looking at the bigger picture administrative state issue and have them back us and help us. And what that really amounts to is they're loaning us part of their army in hopes of them getting part of our army to help them with what they do. And that's the way the world goes round. I can't see Congress ever fixing it because Congress created the problem and it's a way for them to hide from responsibility and accountability for what they do by just not doing it. Just let the administrative state do it. But I think that the courts can potentially fix it, and we might be able to at least start chipping away at it with Congress running at specific targets and creating precedents with those specific targets like the ATF.
So you brought up a really valid point that Congress isn't going to fix itself. So not that we're going to fix this all in this conversation, but I don't know who follows the Convention of States project. It's sort of driven by Mark Levin, love him or hate him, however you want to be with it. But it's basically about fixing the parts of the Constitution that Congress has usurped or whatever. And if we could get enough people in different categories besides ours to get behind something like that, we actually have a chance to possibly fix it. It's something to explore.
I'd
take a look into it.
My only real concern about that is when you do a con like that, it's all up for grabs. You could just as easily lose the entire second and a bunch of others if you do that. And that's the problem.
You need to go educate yourself about how a convention of states works. There's no runaway conventions. It's just like scaring people about when open carry happens, it's going to be a shootout, right? The Convention of States, everything that they're going to vote on will have already been put on a thing before they ever come together and do a vote. There isn't going to be, all of a sudden we got this some surprise thing and then we vote on it. It has to all be prearranged and then it happens. So there is no, we're going to lose the Second Amendment because there's no will for the people to take the Second Amendment away. Sorry, I just needed to have that out there.
I didn't say that's how it would go down, though. I'm saying is when you open up the Constitution like that, you can lose it all. I didn't say anything about a runaway convention.
It's already open. It's part of constitutional law as it stands.
Here's my issue on that is we have a Constitution. The Constitution forbids a lot of what they've been doing and what they are doing. And it's not being properly enforced. If we enforce the Constitution, we wouldn't have to go back and rewrite the Constitution. The Constitution that we have is what it needs to be. We just need to enforce it. And there lies the trick. I don't see it's kind of like
I highly recommend you read the Liberty Amendments because it's not about changing the original Constitution. It's about turning back all the amendments that they've used to corrupt the Constitution.
Well, and the amendments, yeah, you've got there are several of them that are no doubt problematic. But I worry a bit about the whole constitutional conference, convention of states, and all of that. And I'm not an expert on it. I've not dug deeply into it. I've talked with a number of people about it over the years, and I've never been convinced. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, Jeff, you're right though, and I think this is the big problem. Is, and wasn't it George Bush said, you know, Constitution is just a big, you know, piece of paper, and he's not wrong. And the problem is, we're trying to say we'll write a new piece of paper to make the people that enforce the original piece of paper enforce the new piece of paper, which is really absurd on its face. The fact is, we have a culture that doesn't care about the Constitution, and we certainly have an institution. You have to eliminate the entire government and start over, and then hope that it doesn't get corrupted a second time. The problem is, we have a culture problem in our country. That's the problem. It's our culture. If the culture was pro-liberty, it wouldn't matter what the Constitution said at all.
Yeah, but there's also the part, like, I'm going to make an example, the 17th Amendment. The 17th Amendment took it away from when the state Congress chose a representative in the Senate to represent the states at the federal level, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was one of the biggest bonehead moves that we ever did, right? Because now you got politicians that run by popular vote. They have no tie to the local area legislature for what they're doing for the state. They sit there, they collect money, they sign what they want, they don't do what they want. And that's one of the biggest problems with our current system, because we got one branch that's broken because of one amendment, right? So you take that and a couple other key ones out, and things start turning around, and the people's voice makes it back into the federal government again. So as much as I'm with you, yeah, it'd be nice to start over again. Unless we have a revolution, that's not happening, right? So
but
we have to work
down
to what we have.
So if the people that were running for, you know, federal Congress after the 17th Amendment was enacted, and if they were pro-liberty, you wouldn't have room. But they're not.
But the money runs over pro-liberty. That's the problem.
The problem is, we, as a country, we have a fucked up culture.
Look at it backwards. I mean, I'm going to get in the weeds a little bit. But
sure.
Why are those senators getting elected over and over again? You got Nancy Pelosi. I think we can all agree that we'll be glad when she's on the other side of the ground, right?
She's put in such an honest day's work so often that her constituents are just like, dang, we got to.
Yeah, so, but the only reason she exists is not because of her people. She's got so many lobbies that pay for her campaign that nobody could beat her, even if they had everybody in the people's wills.
What you're describing, what Rob just described, though, is a cultural situation. So I'm not going to call it a problem
It's money versus culture, though, because money's paying for it to be in office, not the culture. So the culture doesn't have
a culture because that money turns into advertising, which influences voters. So if voters had the right culture, whatever the advertiser said wouldn't matter. But what happens is advertising works because people don't have a strong will or culture. And they'll vote for whatever they're told. And so that's the problem. So we have a culture problem in this country.
Well, you keep saying problem. Let me say, I'm going to say culture issue, because cultures come and go. Then trends and fads, and we're going to see different things. And so it's not like it's over. It's just a lame position right now. But it's been much different in my lifetime, and then back and forth a few times. It's fluctuated. So what I was going to suggest is, what we're looking at is a bunch of politicians that are as old as Nancy Pelosi, and they're only going to last for so long. And then a new realm of politicians are going to come in, and they're going to be elected by a bunch of constituents who are different than the people that voted in those legacies. And that's an opportunity for a new bunch of people setting in the system that has lasted through lots and lots and lots of waves and trends and fads. So when you get people that are frustrated, you get a reaction in the people that they hire and the people that they choose to represent them and the people that stand up to be in those positions. And then when they get in there, they find the bureaucrats and hopefully run them out of there. And then we see some overhaul. We see some change. I don't think the system is ending. It's just that it's in a bad place, and it'll take people being fed up before they
make change. But I think we got big change coming quickly because, again, these people are old. The people that elected them are no longer going to be voting in any numbers anymore. And the people that are continuing to vote are starting to pick up the swell of voting are people that are appreciate their vote, hopefully. I don't think that I have a lot of confidence in the new population of voters, and they're going to have all kinds of interesting stuff in their
The fact is, and this is where I think I laugh when it comes to all the COVID stuff, where all the conservatives are defending public education. The fact is, public education is the number one determinant at this point of how people vote and their political ideologies. The fact is, and we have generations of people now that have been continuously moved, and someone said something about the Overton window, and I agree with that. And even when I was a kid, they were kind of moving toward that left perspective. And it's only gotten worse over the last, you know, let's just say millennials and Zoomers. And when these people start voting, they've already know that these people are way farther left than at any time in American history. That's a culture change. And it's a culture change directly influenced by socialist communist schools run by the government and the media. And the only way you're going to change it is get your kids out of those government schools. And here's the thing, I think it's just
really funny. I don't know about that.
If you let the government educate your kids, you know, they say there's a saying is, if you send your kids to Caesar to be educated, don't be surprised when they come back Roman. And if you want real change, you got to end public schools, or at least give schools choice and give us a chance to get kids out of the government, you know, education process, because that is affecting. It absolutely is affecting their belief structures and their ideological tendencies when it comes to politics, and they will vote, and they're going to vote hard left, and it's going to get really bad in about another decade because of that, and that's culture. The culture's been changed.
Well, I'm going to jump in here and be rude. I'm sorry. I don't think it's a matter of public education system or anything. I don't really think that becomes a greater issue until, honestly, these students are going on to secondary education, mainly college. With where I am, you know, plenty of public schools, some private schools, but, you know, most everybody I know went to public school and continue to send their children there. And it's a very conservative area. It's what a lot of it boils down to is, one, people need to raise their children and not allow other people to do it for them. They need to stop throwing a TV on and thinking that, you know, they can still go do what they want and the TV is going to be the babysitter. They can instill their values and their beliefs in their children and be the parent and raise their children. If there's something going on at school, they need to be involved and nip it in the bud when they see that happening. But like I said, in the areas I'm in, being more rural and conservative, I'm not seeing this liberal push. Now, like I said, when they go on to college and things like that, that's a more open area. But at that point, is that government run? I think so, because, you know, it's college, you're paying tens of thousands of dollars to go to that. And that's where you see a lot of these professors and things like that pushing more of those ideas.
No, yeah, I'm sorry, but you're mistaken. Even in your rural community, your public school system is under the thumb of the federal government and is being controlled. Your curriculum, your school board, maybe if you've got a good, strong local school board, but they can keep it out to a degree. But I remember growing up, I would have daily arguments with my civics teacher in high school. He insisted that he was a flat-out socialist. He wouldn't say it, but he was. And we had the school down the road, Chino Valley, little podunk town in Arizona, a little farm community, and they had a dress code, and they required their students to cut the boys to have a haircut. They required that people be clean and appropriately dressed for school. And the federal government came in and said, either you stop all of this stuff, or we're going to take away all of your federal funding. And the principal or superintendent of that area said, well, okay, we don't get federal funding, so piss off. But when I came back 3 years later, maybe 4 years later, new people had taken over the Chino Valley School. They were now getting all sorts of federal subsidies and getting new computers for their kids, for their classrooms. And they no longer had their dress code. They no longer had the support for things like 4-H and future farmers. They shifted the whole paradigm, and it's happening in every school in every county across the country. But we're getting a little bit off topic. I'm going to need to bail out. It's always a pleasure to join in on this kind of stuff. I'll encourage everybody to please look at how you can team up with someone else. Pick a topic. Instead of looking at a rights group or looking at an individual rights advocate and saying, I disagree with him, find somebody who you do agree with, but you're not on the same page, and see how you can work together with them, how you can join forces with them, and try and tie our loose-knit community a little bit tighter and get us moving forward. Rob, I'm going to want to talk to you about Tusk sometime in the near future. G-Webs, appreciate you doing this. Every second matters, and we'll talk with you again soon.
All right, so then there is 4. G, if you're talking, you are muted, sir. And if G's not talking, then looks like we lost Luke on Bad Marine. Jeff Knox just peeled out of here, so thank you to him. And Rob, so I didn't mean to like cut you off there. I was just wanted to interject what I experienced in my area, so I do apologize if I was rude at all.
Oh, no, and I think, and I lived in a very rural area as well, and it was interesting, and I'm talking a town of 1,200 people in rural Wyoming, so I've lived in very small towns, and even in that town, though people were mostly quote-unquote conservative Republicans, they were all extraordinarily liberal when it came to government, because the government is one of the largest employers in the state of Wyoming. So when you actually talk about small government, they say, yeah, we believe in small government. Like, oh, that means we can eliminate these 40 jobs that are all sucking off the government taxpayer dime and aren't solving any problems. And then they scream like you've yanked their teeth out. And so just because someone says they're conservative doesn't mean it. So I like to point that out, but I have spent some time researching these topics, and I've thought about this a lot, and I've gotten literally cynical. I think the United States is broken, and I think it is cultural, and it's a long time been broken, and I'm not sure we can vote our way out of that, and I think it's a cultural problem, and the question is, are we going to just die out under, like a whimper, under our own weight of our debt and corruption, or is it going to go out with a bang? And I don't know which way it's going to go. And so I am concerned about that for my own kids, though.
So on the cultural thing, because I like how G put it before, that's not a cultural problem. But what's that, G?
I was just going to say real quick that I'm super optimistic. We got all kinds of booms coming, booms in space, booms in food, booms in tech. And new opportunities and challenges. We're still a player in the big field, and firearms have a good role in that. I don't see the system as damaged. I just see it as in a weird place, and we're in
pendulum swings or cycles. And
the boomers are retiring and dying, and the pendulum's going to shift. It's just a matter of how far.
Yeah, there'll be good times again, and then you just got to be careful not to appreciate the good times and double down for the good stuff or whatever. Anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I just want to say that.
No, you're fine.
Go ahead.
So, going on that whole cultural issue or cultural problem, do you guys think that we're possibly on the precipice of a new culture shift, having been through what we have in the last 2 years with COVID? And, I mean, look at the surge in firearms ownership. Now, if you want to believe the numbers that were touted of, 9 million new gun owners, which I would say, if we are lucky, is a third of that, just given statistics when you start looking at how certain organizations want to break them down and whatnot. But, even if we got a third of that, that's still 3 million gun owners that are new, and that's what?
I don't look at gun owners.
Membership, that's a lot. So is it possible that we are on a cultural shift here, where we don't even have to worry about voting so much, as where people are just gonna they're gonna run? And I'm talking in circles, so I apologize.
The politicians will be different, right? Like, if we won't have to look for a new politician, different people will want to be politicians.
So you got to look at what happened with Trump getting elected. Trump was not the Republicans' choice for president, right? He can't come up and jumped over it. If there's enough will in the people to elect a president that isn't sponsored by the prime party that elected him, there's some will out there to do some changes or whatever. They just have to have the right alignment and the right direction and the right education or whatever. And in the end, because there's a lot of uneducated voters, we're basically looking at learning how to make them educated voters, or doing our part to see that whatever little bit of our world they see educates them in a positive fashion.
But I think we have to see new, just because, again, I look at the populations of people. The baby boomers are becoming less. We're not, whatever our generation is in between, we're not big enough. We're just a small number because there's fewer of us. We're fractioned. And then this new generation, whatever they are called, that is like 20 right now, like that generation has taken the baton from the baby boomers, and they are different, and they'll have all the influence pretty soon. So it has to be a shift. Whether or not they're competent, and you have confidence in them, I guess that's a big question, right? But I think guns is something that they've championed. They're not as scared of it. I think they've taken ownership of it. And if they haven't, at least they calm their jets. They don't seem to be as freaked out by each other if they own guns.
Right. And as much as I hate to say it, all these gun-based games aren't hurting how they feel about guns, because they're almost desensitized to what guns are, because it's just a part of their little games or whatever. And they actually want to have one. Like my son's best friend, once he got 21, he started buying all these guns that he saw that he got to play with in the games, at least the ones that were available to him and his finances or whatever. And his parents aren't gun people. Definitely fell more on the more anti-gun side of the world, if it were, or whatever. But he's a gun owner and learning gun stuff from people like me and other people in the community that are embracing him as he grows or whatever. So there is hope. There is definitely change. And there is a lot of this, a lot of what they're seeing in the media is affecting how they feel about guns. And to a sense that the games and the violent movies, as much as some people say that violence is bad or whatever, not everybody sees that way. And some of these kids see cool guns that they might be able to own or whatever, and that's working in our favor.
So Idaho is saying I doubt 9 million new gun owners, maybe 1 million people bought 9 new guns.
Yeah, that doesn't really line up with the economics of what the average American has per disposable income for firearms, but you might be able to meet somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But it depends on where you get those numbers. I've never agreed with them. When you got states that require universal background checks, then that's 4473s that are happening, and it has nothing to do with a new gun. That's just grandpa gives three granddaughters. That's three 4473s, and nothing happened except that grandpa gave granddaughters guns, right? So they're going to count that as three new gun owners. I guess technically, maybe in some way, but then there's some NSSF numbers that go based off of sales. But then again, when it's like inflation, dire, like news or political issues, that's like when people decide to buy guns as investments. So I don't see gun sales as new gun owners either. That's just somebody, you know, whatever. And like I keep saying, the generations are changing. So as people get inheritances or people get life insurance policies or something, you know, and they decide to invest, they're going to buy steel and brass and lead, right? We know that.
So I know they tout the 9 million off of the 4473s, like you were just saying. You know, there is 9 million more done in what, 2020 than any other year prior. And that's where they say, so we got 9 million new gun owners, which, I mean, I understand why they say it that way, but, you know, when people start to really think about it, it's not possible. And, you know, the funny thing is, you'd hear the GOA say 9 million new gun owners this year, but then it was the GOA that said during GRPC that same year that new gun owners are going out and they're buying a handgun for self-defense, and then they're like, I need something for at home. So then they go out and buy another gun, and they get a home defense shotgun. And then they go and they're like, I want a, you know, gun to defend against tyranny, and they're going out and buying an AR-15. So that means you just took 9 million new gun owners, as you tout it, and said that they bought three guns on three separate occasions, which means at least three 4473s for those three people, which instantly takes it down to 3 million people. And I'm just like, are they not paying attention to the numbers that they're actually touting then?
It doesn't fit their narrative.
Oh, I realize that. But, you know, if you go off that theory, then there's at best 3 million. Then if you cut that in half, 1.5 million if we're lucky.
Yeah. And if you want to go on a real dive or whatever, look at how the firearm sales increase in a change of party, presidential change. It generally swings higher when a Democrat's coming into office, but even when a certain Republicans come into office, there's a swing from people that might be on the other side of the fence. You know, just the apprehension of what the unknown, I don't know how you call those people, but people that buy guns politically scared, we'll call them that.
Well, to be a host, I want to make note that, you know, we're having a little bit of political stuff, but that 2A has to be political, obviously. But I think that we could go around forever the same way I cut it off when we were talking about the specifics of the investment side of crypto or whatever. Right. Like this, when we get into politics, that could be a whole other discussions for people that really want to dig into that side as far as third parties and all that. So if I want to cut anybody off if they had something that way. But first, I guess we're about to be at 2 hours, so I appreciate everybody who's joined us. You're under no obligation to stick around, but I'll keep going. We've got people watching, and this is all about just to have, you know, conversations so that things can spark and come up, or, you know, and usually it's pretty good and productive. I have a couple of comments starred over here, but I figured just go through, say thanks again to Rob for jumping in from Tusk, the Universal Settlement Coin. We've got Guns and Barbecue, who does shows on YouTube. Luke, who has L3D, 3D printing guru. And Echo, hasn't been saying so much, but he's got a lot going on his end down in Florida, hosts a lot of live conversations. We've had Jeff from, Firearms Policy? No, Firearms Coalition, which was around before Firearms Policy Coalition. And he and his brother wrote a book of his dad's articles, and Jeff will be at the 2A rally here in Arizona coming up on February 19th. We also had, who else was in here? Smeggy was in here, and somebody else in here?
I think Smeggy was the other.
And Smeggy from California is still out there as well. So anyway, I just introduced everybody again, and palate cleanser. We had something about the Overton window. If anybody had any thoughts on that one, I personally think that's an interesting one. And it's something that, well, I think first it's achievable. I've seen stuff change the Overton window just in my awareness of what's going on. As far as being able to get everybody on board to try to do it, I mean, that would be tough. But anyway, that one's an interesting topic. Otherwise, I'll shut up. If anybody else has any other topics, I don't need to.
I wish Smeggy was still in here because I wanted to ask him way back when we started, when he was talking about, you know, how he just will drum up a conversation at work. And, you know, next thing you know, the guys are crawling out of the woodworks like, oh, yeah, I own guns, too. This is awesome. I wanted to ask him, you know, has he ever asked those people, why don't you be more open about it? You know, so anybody on here has ever gotten to ask anybody that question? I would love to know what some of those answers are.
There's, I don't know. I have plenty of people that approach me within my extended group, friends group, to talk about guns that wouldn't talk with any of their other friends about guns. But I think that's a sort of an introvert, extrovert type personality trait, not as much the desire to forward the gun cause. And I'm willing to bet we could teach some people to maybe learn how to have those conversations better. But there's a lot of your own character that goes into your willingness to have those conversations, to have the confrontations that can come from that, or having to defend your own views, or be, some people are even afraid of being seen differently by their friends, by becoming the gun guy instead of just being whatever they are currently in their social circle, right? So there's a lot to unpack with that.
So, you know, it's, cause in my world, because I'm in the crypto space pretty heavily as well as the 2A space, and the crypto space originally was started by like ANCAPs and libertarians. And because it's software and gotten so big, a lot of the lefty Silicon Valley stuff has come back to it. In fact, if you look at where most of the exchanges are and a lot of the hubs are, they're in Seattle, San Francisco, and New York. And so I deal a lot with people in this space because I think we're the only project that really is doing gun stuff seriously, but we're also one of the only crypto products focused on an industry. Like most of them are just, you know, talking about investments and stuff. And it's funny, the conversations I have, and most of the people that seem to be the most anti-gun that I talk to come from places where they are not allowed to have guns, or it's almost impossible to have guns. And they're just, it's just an alien thing to them. And this goes back once again, where I think the United States has broken culture, is that not only were they raised in a place where it's okay for the government to ban stuff, of course they've been scared by the media, but they have literally no context. Like, it's hard for me. You know what I'm saying? Is that they have no context.
Their context is bad guys have guns and cops mm-hmm. have guns, and that's all they know. They don't
exactly.
know
but,
normal
well, that's
people
what I
having
mean.
Guns. Yeah.
But I guess that's what I mean. Okay, is like yeah. they don't ever come in contact with people that are normal people that shoot. And I try to explain that they really believe the caricatures of Bubba with the gun and the gun rack and yahoos and they see the people that go to these, you know, rallies looking, you know, up in Portland and stuff and doing, I don't know. They take a certain caricature presented to them by the news, and that's their idea of every gun person, which we know that's not correct. In fact, most gun people I know are, you know, very well off financially, are, you know, have very large amounts of money invested in guns and are pretty sane, rational, reasonable, salt of the earth kind of people. But they don't know that. And so I think that's part of the problem is that, and a lot of this goes back to schools, it goes back to what's happening in these liberal states, is that they're just through attrition and changing the culture is how we're losing these rights just because of that. And it's just a long game. It's a long game that's happening here. But most of these people just, they don't see a need. It's not part of their, it's not part of their history. It's not part of their culture. You go, someone is born and raised in Queens, right? I mean, where BB guns are considered guns, real guns, like guns aren't a thing. So it's like,
well,
it's like,
well, they are a thing, but they're unobtainium to them.
Correct. But
those people only care about guns once they've been attacked by somebody who's a criminal with a gun. And then they decide, oh, maybe it's important that I have a right to have that gun. But unfortunately, the ratio of people that get attacked to the ratio of people that don't care is imbalanced.
And most of the people that get attacked and the ones that are most subject to violent crime are, you know, minorities in the inner city. And they don't have any power, typically even less so than the average upscale white liberal that's voting against this stuff. Yeah. And so it's really funny. So I'll be on Clubhouse, and I really like the Clubhouse app. And I will be in a Clubhouse room that's more focused on technology, and, you know, people start, of course, there's always radical Canadians or liberals from New York and stuff that just start going off on the ad hominems because of, you know, the typical you want babies dead kind of concept. And then I'll say no, and I'll point out facts that the people that, and I say this, is that people that have never had to worry about their personal safety are probably about the most privileged people that I know. I grew up in a rough area outside Detroit. And it's funny because in the back channel, people are messaging me, like, minorities are messaging me like, yeah, you're right. You know, it is dangerous in these inner cities and we do need protection. And it's right. Just kind of, it's kind of interesting, the dichotomy.
Why can't we leverage the fact that at any given point during the conflict in Afghanistan, more people were getting killed in Chicago by gun violence, by criminals, than what happened over there? And it had everything to do with the fact that they had a preclusion on concealed carry or personal carry of firearms. Now that they've added it, I'd like to go see the numbers, but I got to assume that it's slowly going to trend down as more and more citizens become armed and more criminals figure out that it's less safe to aggress their victims when their victims can shoot back, right? It's going to take time. But that happened, and that was a huge win for, at least for those people there, right? It didn't really affect me much, but I was all for it, you know? If I thought it would improve their program, I'd support an agency that furthers getting guns into the hand of people there that can't afford them. You know what I mean?
So PNW Woods had a really good point. He says, you know, basically, I don't think people in the city are anti-gun as much as gun indifferent. It's just not a big deal to them. And I think that's a true statement. But guys, I'm turning into a pumpkin here. I want to say thanks to everybody for being on the show. It's a good conversation. Hope I can be a part of it in the future. And you have just hit me up after the show. But I got a jet. If anybody's interested in learning about what we're doing, just check us out at TUSC.network, TUSC.network. And you have a good night, guys.
Yeah, thanks for joining. You're going to be on with for when?
I'm on all the time. I got some things. I got another thing. I got another stream I got to jump on. So I'll see you guys later.
All right. Thanks
Rob.
Yeah, I'll throw a link out there. He's going to be on Clover's chat here in next week or something.
I feel bad for coming in a little hot on him on the amendment stuff or whatever, but if you really don't understand the dynamics of it, there's a lot of stuff that could be affected, and there's already a group of people working on it that we could get behind that might help us long-term or whatever, and so I tend to be a little bit more...